I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Join us on our quest to find awe and wonder in all nature, human or wild, vast or small. A podcast in search of all that moves us beyond words. Your host for this episode is Tenery Taylor.
I think all of us are facing these two essential questions, which is, how do we stay calm in this world of mounting uncertainty? And how do we maintain hope in the face of impermanence?
Pico Iyer has traveled to more than 80 countries and written more than a dozen books based on those travels. He's a close personal friend of the Dalai Lama. In all his travels, Pico has trained his eye on sacred spaces. Why are sacred spaces, particularly those quiet or silent places, those conducive to meditation, why are they so essential to the soul? Pico Iyer's latest book is A Flame, Learning from Silence. And we'll explore with him a question his book seems to elicit. How are meditation, silence, retreat, and fire connected? We reached him at his home in Japan. Throughout his extensive travels, Pico has often noted the weighty sacrifices required for some people to reach sacred spaces.
I think often in places where people have very little, their faith means everything. It's the one thing that's sustaining them. And I feel that the more they're lacking in material goods sometimes, the more essential spiritual sustenance is. And it's a very, very moving thing. I'm thinking now of Varanasi, the sacred space in Hinduism, which is the city of death, but it's also the city of joy. And as I'm walking through the little narrow alleyways of Varanasi, I would see groups of people racing past carrying a dead body to be burnt along the side of the river Ganges, because it's believed that if you commit a dead body to that river, it will receive moksha or liberation. And the surprising thing for me is that as the family members were carrying the dead bodies through these alleyways, they were singing songs of praise and gratitude and delight. And rather than mourning the death, they were celebrating the fact that they could commit the departed one to the holy waters. For somebody who grew up in England and the United States, as I did, it's so moving to go to place after place across the planet where faith is so burning alive and where people are making great sacrifices and taking great pains and giving up weeks and months of their life to pay their respects to holy places.
On another trip, Pico crossed paths with somebody who gave up more than just time and money in order to pay homage at a shrine in the heavily populated city of Mashhad, Iran.
After a day of sightseeing, I wanted to steal away and see the country and the city without my guide and my driver. So I sent them off to dinner. And then I slipped down to the taxi desk in the hotel lobby and I asked if they could introduce me to somebody to take me right into the heart of town. And very soon, a young man, really friendly, in his late 20s, speaking surprisingly good English, came up and invited me into his little compact. And we headed out into the night and towards the central shrine in Mashhad, which is actually the largest mosque in the world. And unbeknownst to me, I had arrived in the city on the most festive week of the year because it was the celebration of the saint who was long dead, 1,200 years dead, but was buried in that shrine. So 5 million people had come from every corner of the Shia world to mark the occasion. All the streets were filled with fairy lights. And when we got to the shrine, which actually consists of these 7 huge marble courtyards, essentially we could barely walk. Everywhere there are people seated on the ground under this huge pulsing full moon. They were sharing tea and sweets. They were stretched out asleep in some cases because they were spending 7 days and 7 nights there. All around them were these huge video screens on which Ayatollahs were delivering sermons. So we could barely walk. But finally we came to the Holy of Holies, the innermost sanctum where the saint is buried. And the driver looked across at me appraisingly, and I think he thought, well, this man has come all the way across the world and spent a lot of time and money. He wants to get to know our culture. So he invited me in with him to the central shrine. It was very small, extremely crowded. We quickly got separated. And at one point, I looked across the room and I could see my young driver, and his hand was on his heart and he was walking backwards so he would never present his back to the long dead saint. And there were tears welling in his eyes. He was just the picture of Islamic purity, and it really meant a lot to him.
But there was still more to this young man's devotion.
When we were back out on the street and we were walking towards his car, he told me that he had a wife back in England who was from Yorkshire and who was awaiting their first baby. And then he told me that he had paid a human trafficker $2,500 to smuggle him into England in the back of a truck, breathing through a tube so he wouldn't be detected. And then he told me how the British government very generously had given him a court-appointed lawyer and translator, and they'd worked for 3 years to win him asylum status. And yet, while he was in England, he couldn't help missing his mother, his hometown, and that central mosque. So having risked his life to steal out of Iran, now he was risking his life every summer to steal back into Iran. And he told me how sometimes when he was in England, he would call his brother on the phone and ask the brother to go to the shrine just so he could hear the shrine at a distance. It was such a large part of him that he was missing. And so when he dropped me back at my hotel that evening, I thought, all Iran, of course, has been on our front pages every day for many seasons now. And yet I'd never heard about a really faithful, pious Islamic soul who nonetheless didn't want to live in this Islamic Republic. And I'd never heard about a dissident stealing back into the country from which he'd fled every year because a part of him missed a part of it so much. If Iran were to find that this dissident had stolen out of the country and broken many laws and now was back there, I think he would have been in a lot of trouble, and he might even have been in trouble for admitting me, who's not part of the Islamic tradition, into that sacred shrine. Traditionally, foreigners were not allowed to enter the whole mosque on pain of death. So he was taking a lot of risks in his keenness to welcome me and to share with me the beauty of his religious background and tradition. And so it's a very humbling experience that reminded me how little I know of the world and how the world is always beautifully more complicated than we imagine.
Pico Iyer has his own holy place, a place of silence. And he found it when he may have needed it most, when he'd lost everything. In 1990, Pico was 33 years old and staying at his childhood home in the hills of Central California.
It lives very vividly inside me, even though now it was soon be 35 years ago. But it was a very hot summer evening in Santa Barbara, and I was in our family home in the hills, and I saw this distant knife of orange cutting through a faraway hillside. So naturally, I went downstairs to call the fire department. And when I came upstairs again, just 5 minutes later, our house was completely encircled by 70-foot flames, 5 stories high. So worst fire in Californian history at that time. It had broken out just up the road from us, and I was actually caught in it. I grabbed my mother's cat. We ran out. We jumped into a car to try to escape. We went down our driveway, and at the bottom of our driveway, we saw that we couldn't go up and we couldn't go down. The smoke was so thick, we could hear helicopters above, but they couldn't see us and we couldn't see them. And the fire was so intense, no fire truck could get up to us. And the only thing that saved us was a Good Samaritan who'd been driving along the freeway, and he'd seen a fire break out in the hills. And because he had a big water truck, he drove up to be of help. And by chance, he ended up stranded right next to our driveway. So when we got to the bottom of the driveway, there he was, shirtless, in his shorts, with a hose. And every time a wall of fire approached from the east, he would just poke the hose towards it and it would recede. And then a wall of fire would approach from the west and he would turn the hose in that direction. And really, by saving his life, he saved our own. And at one point, during the 3 hours when we were stuck there, for 45 minutes, I was right under my house. And so I could see the flames systematically making their way through our living room and then moving down to my bedroom and reducing every childhood toy and memento to ash. And then actually wiping out 8 years of writing because my next three books were all in handwritten notes and all of that got wiped out. So when finally a fire truck could get up to us and tell us it was safe to drive downtown at last, I went to an all-night supermarket and I bought a toothbrush. That literally was the only thing I had to start my life anew. And it seemed quite startling at the time and unusual in 1990. But sadly, of course, now there are more and more fires in every corner of the world and more people in this predicament.
Did you feel like I've lost so much? I mean, those would be some demons for me. You know, if that's where I ended up is in a place all by myself with my toothbrush, it would take me a long time to get over losing three manuscripts. And that's just the beginning of what you lost.
Well, let me tell you a couple of things. And I'll begin by saying that when I went to sleep on my friend's floor the night of the fire, before I went to sleep, I asked if I could use a computer because my job in those long ago days was to be a columnist for Time magazine. And I just had a front seat view on this major breaking news event, the worst fire in Californian history. So I went to the computer and the very evening of the fire, I wrote up an account of sitting in that scratchy hot afternoon, getting impatient in my eye doctor's office and then driving to the house and then seeing the fire and then finally being able to drive down through a landscape that looked like the footage I'd seen of the Vietnam War with houses burning on all sides of me and the hulks of cars along the side of the road. And because I'd been spending time in Japan, I ended my piece with a 17th century haiku that I had discovered that was not very well known then, though now I hear it more often. And it's by somebody called Masahide, who said, "My house burnt down. I can now see better the rising moon." So the 3 hours after I lost everything in the world, something in me, much wiser than I am, I think, realized it wasn't only loss and that I wouldn't be able to assess it in terms of loss and gain for many years to come. And also that if nothing else, it would make my priorities much sharper than they had been. I was thinking of the fire a lot during the pandemic because it was at such a time of tragedy and anxiety for pretty much every human on the planet. But I think many of us found that suddenly we remembered with new force what we really care about. We stayed closer to our families. We made contact with friends that we hadn't been in touch with for a while. We took walks in our neighborhood and suddenly realized how beautiful our neighborhoods were. And in other words, for all the doors that were closed by the pandemic or by this fire, others were opened. In terms of the immediate loss, I think I came so close to losing my life that losing my possessions wasn't the worst thing in the world. At the end of that evening, I almost felt I'd come out ahead because I'd been saved by the miracle of the Good Samaritan. Also, I think going through that event emotionally was much easier than for my poor mother who was visiting a nephew in Florida who just got a phone call from me that evening saying, "By the way, you've lost everything in the world." And because she hadn't witnessed it and she was far away, she said, "There must be something. You must be able to retrieve something." "No, sorry. I was right next to that fire. Impossible to save even a spoon or even my passport, which was 2 feet away from me. I didn't feel I have time to salvage my important papers." And so I think she felt absolutely powerless, where I had the catharsis of going through it and also saw that there was nothing that could be done. And I think the final component is that I was 33 at the time and my mother was 59. And at 33, it's much easier to think in terms of starting afresh. And I lost those three books, but I felt still I have more books inside me. And the fact that I could write that article the evening of the fire reminded me I haven't lost everything. I still have my words. I still have my memories. I can speak back to nature. I'm not entirely its victim. Whereas for my mother at 59, I think it was almost impossible to start again. And she felt all her life with her husband, her girlhood, her motherhood had been wiped clean. And I think that was a very, very hard thing.
It would be a quiet place. Profoundly quiet, located some 50 miles south of Monterey on California's Big Sur coastline, a place that would help Pico Iyer to continue to make sense of what he'd gained and what he'd lost. The new Komaldali Hermitage, a type of monastery, ultimately a place of healing and renewal for Pico.
I was sleeping on a friend's floor, and another friend said, if you're sleeping on the floor, why don't you go and try this Catholic monastery, because at least you'll have a bed to sleep in and a desk and a nice garden, all for $30 a night in those days. If you go to the little town of San Luis Obispo in central California and you drive north along Highway 1, that road gets narrower and emptier till you're just in this vast elemental landscape with golden meadows running down from the hills on one side and the great flat blue plate of the Pacific Ocean on the other. And then you, after maybe 2 hours, you come to an even narrower road that snakes and twists up to the top of a hill for 2 miles, maybe 7-8 minutes. When you get out of your car there, the silence is pulsing. It's not just the absence of noise. It's really the presence of everything, a very strong presence. And I've found this in every monastery and convent I've been to in any order across the world. And if you're going to stay there, and I've been more than 100 times over 34 years, you usually occupy a small room, but very comfortable, with a bed and a desk and a private walled garden looking out over the Pacific Ocean. And the beauty of it for me is that as soon as I step into that wide awake, positive silence, I'm released from myself. It's as if all my fretting and my hopes and my resume and all my constant agitation are left down on the highway, and I'm released to the wonder and the glory that's all around. I remember the first time I arrived there, I saw a rabbit on the splintered fence in the garden. And I just stared at that rabbit as if it were a miracle. And there were often rabbits around our house, 4 hours to the south in the hills of California. But of course, I never took the time to look at them. I was never present to them, or I would hear a phone ringing in the background. And I remember hearing, soon after I saw the rabbit, bells tolling behind me. And I honestly couldn't tell if the bells were inside me or outside me. It was as if all divisions between within and without have been dissolved. And it's a remarkable thing that, as I say, over and over for 34 years, I go into that same simple space and I feel liberated and cleansed and able to return to my regular life with a great sense of calm and joy. This is a Catholic monastery, and it belongs to a group of Benedictines who a part of the most contemplative congregation within the Catholic Church. And I'm not even a Christian, but the monks are so generous that they open their doors and hearts to everybody, whatever your tradition or lack of tradition. And I think they're confident that whoever you are, in that pulsing silence, you will find what is deepest inside you. And you might call it God, you might call it reality, your better self, but it doesn't really matter what words you use for it. You will find the most important thing in life.
So silence is required at the monastery?
No, you know, one of the interesting things about the retreats there, you know, you can stay up to 2 weeks, is that there are really no rules. They're not guided retreats. Everybody is left free to do whatever he or she wants. And I say she because probably the majority of the people on retreat are women, even though it's an all-male monastic community. So the beauty of it for me is that every morning I follow the moment, I follow instinct or intuition. Sometimes I'll just decide I'll take a walk and I'll see the sun rising over the hills. Sometimes I'll just pick a book out at random from my suitcase. Sometimes I'll just sit in my garden looking out over the water and do nothing at all, which is exactly what I never allow myself to do the rest of the time. Even when I'm on holiday, I'm one of those infuriating people who makes plans and maps out every minute. And this is a true holy day where I allowed myself to do anything. All the people who go there are seeking out some kind of silence and clarity. So you're asked to be quiet around the retreat house, but you're welcome to go for a long walk along the monastery road and talk to a friend or partner. I go there now with my wife, and we stay in separate rooms, but we share meals together and we take walks 2-3 times a day, sometimes under this overturned salt shaker of stars. The stars are so abundant at night, sharing what we're feeling. And of course, some people do go there for spiritual counsel. There are 5 services every day in the chapel, and anybody is welcome to join the monks for that. And many people, quite often as I'm walking along the road, I'll see somebody walking with one of the monks, probably pouring out her heart and seeking solace or guidance. So there are really no rules. Part of the beauty, of course, is that there's no cell phone reception there. There's no internet, clearly no televisions. But it's not just those absences that make it so powerful. There's the presence, I think, created by, in this case, 60 years of prayer and meditation. And it's almost as if the silence is a series of transparent glass walls. It's something that you can almost touch and that quickly, I think, clarifies whoever you are.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand what you're saying, and I'm thinking of the silence of a church,
yes,
or the silence,
yes,
in the mountains, the silence of a library. So those are places that we are used to being quiet. How's the quality of silence different there?
Well, I love that question, and I love your perception. And early on in my book, I say that the silence I find in this monastery or any monastery or convent is not the same as just the silence of being on a mountaintop or a forest. It's something, as I say, active and positive, and that's been almost constructed through prayer. But it probably is very similar to the silence you would find in a church. And I know many people I meet say, well, I really don't have the time and resources to go on retreat. And I would say to them, well, you could go on a walk in your hometown or go to a park, but maybe best of all, step into a church. I remember when I first went to New York City 43 years ago, and I had a day of job interviews, and I was trying to become a journalist. So it was a very busy, stressful day. But even then, I had the sense, as I was walking from interview to interview, I just would step into St. Patrick's Church. And instantly, I would feel released. And just the smell of the incense and the light coming through the windows and the fact that people were praying all around me gave me just the medicine I needed. And in the middle of that clamorous streets of New York City with horns honking and people rushing by, just to step into that church reminded me of some much deeper reality and some much truer part of myself. So I think churches, synagogues, mosques, temples, all have that very specific quality of silence. Also, it has to do with a sense of time. Because, as you said earlier, I travel quite a bit. I realized at an early point in my life that the more time I was spending in airport time, when destinations are clicking over and everyone's very conscious of the clock and pretty stressful, the more I should spend in cathedral time. And that means that, for example, when any of us steps into Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, suddenly we become very small. Everything around us, this darkness, is much larger than we will ever be in terms of history and in terms of geography. And we're just surrounded by candles and the light through the stained glass window, and maybe somebody singing a hymn or a psalm at the other end of the church. And it puts us in place, and it returns the world to its proper proportions. And so whenever I'm feeling rushed in my life, as too often I might be, I think it's important to step into a church, and that offers release and a kind of entry into sacred time. You know, the Greeks had 2 different words for time, chronos, which is the time of the calendar, and kairos, which is sacred time, which is the time when we step out of time, when we feel like we're touching eternity. And if ever I'm too much lost in the calendar, I feel now it's time to taste whatever exists beyond time.
I hear what you're saying about cathedrals, and I just want to clarify, because a cathedral is a big, expensive building. It sounds like New Camaldoli is a more of a humble place.
Yes, it's very humble.
You know, so I'm curious if the atmosphere is not just constructed or enabled by the building itself, the decorations, but almost by the intent and purposes of the people who are there with you, of the people who have been there before.
100%. That's beautifully said. Yes, and you put it much better than I. Exactly. The intent and the fact that the monks, this, as I say, it's the most contemplative congregation within the Catholic Church. So they're spending 4 hours alone every day in meditation, and they're the unusual monks who don't all sleep under the same roof. Each one of them has his own cell, his own little building with a garden. So they're deeply contemplative, and that helps to create that atmosphere, as you say. And what also helps is that all the visitors, are about 15 at any given time, are coming in search of silence. So we're bringing our most silent and our most sacred parts to that, and we're trying really hard not to desecrate the silence. And as I said before, there are no rules, but everybody there, by definition, wants to observe the silence and maintain it as much as possible. And then I think the third factor is anyone who's been to the Big Sur coastline, which is 60 miles of coastline with fewer than 2,000 people in residence, knows that that landscape already gives you, it's like a natural cathedral. It's full of tall redwoods and an enormous unbroken stretch of ocean and a vast blue sky and tall cliffs. And already the human element feels very small, and you feel as if you're part of something much larger and much more significant and enduring than you are. But you're absolutely right. I think intent is what creates that silence.
Does that kind of silence ever feel oppressive? Maybe it's so unusual, or maybe things come up inside of you when you are in that kind of silence. Can it be oppressive to people?
Perfectly said. And must be confessed that soon after I began staying there, I went one time and there was this torrential winter storm. And all night long, the rain was pattering on the roof and the aged heater was groaning in the cold. And the very foundations of the flimsy wooden room in which I was staying seemed to be shaking. And I would look out the window and I couldn't see a single sign of human habitation. I couldn't see a light. And I realized just to get some milk, I would have to walk through this tremendous storm. And it was very lonely and frightening. And it was really like spending 40 days and nights in the wilderness. And of course, the next day when I awoke, the sun had arisen and the storm had cleared. But while I was there, I was reminded that there were no guarantees. Thomas Merton, the great Trappist monk who spent 27 years living in a kind of silence in Gethsemane in Kentucky, says, if you seek out contemplation in search of anything, you'll be disappointed. There are no guarantees. And what always shakes me when I'm there during stormy nights is that it's hard for me to be there for 8 hours of tumult. But the monks have committed to their entire lives there and to living in the cell on close terms with their doubts and their fears and their frustrations. And I'm really humbled by the courage involved in that, because they are truly walking out into the wilderness. And many of them have gone there because they feel called by God, but sometimes God disappears for a while, or they can't find God in their heart. And there they are, with nowhere to run and nowhere to hide. So I'm glad you asked that, because you're absolutely right that, you know, light only has meaning with shadow, and it's not always sunlight there. In that undistracted silence, one's demons do jump out at one, and one's shadows do rise to the top, and sometimes bad memories may arise, or sometimes you have to confront the parts of yourself you'd rather run away from, but there's nowhere to run to. But even in those moments, I always feel I'd rather deal with my shadows or demons in that essentially safe and protected place than when I'm driving down the freeway, or when I'm in the supermarket, or when I'm in the tumult of my regular life, when I'm already probably a little rattled and unsettled, and I'm not in my deepest or strongest self. So the shadows are not going to go away of their own accord, and I'm happiest to meet them, even if I can't defeat them, when I'm at my clearest, which is always when I'm in that monastery.
You've written about the need to preserve monasteries, not just so people like you or me could go there for a week, but because we need places on earth for people who have made these kind of commitments. But why? Why do I need that? Why do I need a place where someone else has made a commitment like that?
The monks, whom I've been watching for 34 years, are such a model of devotion, compassion, selflessness, that it really reminds me of what many of us, I think, aspire to be. And as you say, I have never summoned that degree of commitment, but to see somebody do it and to see these monks who've essentially taken vows of obedience, which means not just obeying God, not just obeying their prior, the head of the community, but obeying every other monk in the community, some of whom they might never have chosen to live with in other circumstances, is really, really moving. And nowadays, we all know there are a lot of retreat centers and New Age religious centers and yoga places and spas, lots of quiet places. But most of them are centered around a human being who will not live forever and is probably not infallible or immortal. And many of them ask you to subscribe to a certain philosophy, and they're exclusive of those who don't. And so for retreatants like myself, it's wonderful to be in a place that doesn't ask of you anything but gives you so much. But most of all, what it gives you is the example of these monks.
It's not just a contemplative lifestyle which proves the monk's devotion, though. Remember how New Camaldoli, the place, with its atmosphere of sacrifice and worship, cultivated by the monks and by their visitors, well, that place itself is subject to the all-consuming ravages of fire.
Because these monks live on 900 acres of remote wilderness in central California, they're permanently encircled by fire. And I remember a few years ago, towards the end of the pandemic, suddenly a terrible fire broke out on the property right next to theirs, and most of the monks had to run for their lives. And just three stayed behind to help the firefighters try to protect their home. And one of them was the prior, the center of the community, and he would send out updates every now and then to anxious friends such as myself. And one day he wrote, "We're standing here, we three monks, and there's smoke everywhere, and we can see pulsing lights. And every now and then a roar of orange leaps over the ridge just 200 yards behind us. But don't worry, we're maintaining our offices, we're practicing matins and vespers and vigils every day in the chapter room. Blessed day all. Blessed day all," he said, on the day when it looked as if he could lose his life and lose everything that he cared for. So quite apart from their lifelong commitment, that degree of confidence and conviction, especially in a world that to me is ever more anxious and sometimes despairing, is exactly what we need to witness. And it's very hard, I find, to discover elsewhere in my day-to-day life.
We'll continue our conversation with Pico Iyer in just a moment. And we'll consider the role of fire in each of our lives. Well, at least the metaphorical fire of tumult and trauma, and also the healing power of silence to quiet our fears. And get this, to make us better neighbors. How does retreat into silence make us better citizens? We'll find out when Constant Wonder returns. I'm Tenery Taylor.
I've got another podcast to recommend to you from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's called The Appleseed. Each episode features master storytellers sharing all kinds of stories for you and your family, folk tales, fairy tales, personal and family tales. It's ideal for road trips, bedtime, or any time you're looking for something that the whole family can enjoy together. And here's a great side effect of listening to The Appleseed. It has a nearly magical ability to conjure up a whole lot of healthy storytelling right at home, and it often prompts the sharing of precious memories as well. Be sure to catch The Appleseed wherever you get your podcasts. We now return to Constant Wonder.
Fires are increasing, gaining ground in the California hills. We all know that. Pico Iyer's book was released on January 14, 2025, right in the middle of a month-long inferno that displaced 100,000 people in the Los Angeles area.
When I brought out this book, A Flame, in January, I actually went and gave a reading in Pasadena, California, a few days after the fires had swept through there. And many of the people in the room had just lost everything in the world, as I did many years ago. I heard myself telling them that initially, of course, it presented itself as loss. But as the months and years went on, I could see that actually it made possible certain good things that I might never have claimed otherwise. And that really did liberate me for all the ways that it closed off opportunities. And one small example is that when the insurance company came a few months after the fire and generously offered to replace all our belongings, of course, I realized that I could happily do without 90% of the books and the clothes and the furniture I'd accumulated. I'd always wanted to live a simple, uncluttered life, and I'd acquired much too much stuff. And I realized now I can actually live much closer to the life I'd always dreamed of. Having lost all my notes, I thought, well, now I'm going to have to write from memory and from imagination and from emotion, which are really much deeper sources than my notes. Because I'd grown up traveling between different cultures, I'd always felt that home is not the place where you live, it's what lives inside you. And the day after the fire, I had no physical home on the planet. I still had my mother, I still had my wife-to-be, I still had my favorite songs that play in my head, I still had the books that really sustain me. So much of what I consider the heart of myself was still alive, even though the material things were gone.
So what are some of the metaphorical fires that you tackled in this book? And how can silence and contemplation and retreat help with the metaphorical fires in our lives?
I think all of us are really facing this question of how we can keep the inner fires of confidence and conviction and faith alive when the external fires are playing havoc with our lives. I remember Jung, Carl Gustav Jung, many years ago said, the difference between a good life and a bad life is how you walk through the fire. And as you said, fire is in some ways a metaphor. Many people are dealing with wildfires, but others are dealing with hurricanes or typhoons or tsunamis or floods or the plague, the coronavirus. But I think all of us are facing these two essential questions, which is how do we stay calm in this world of mounting uncertainty? And how do we maintain hope in the face of impermanence? And I think the best answer I can give and the direct answer to your question is what I was saying about those monks remaining so unperturbed in the middle of a literal fire when it looked like they would lose everything. Why are they so confident? Partly because of their faith, I think, but partly because of their years of silence and retreat and contemplation. And I think of it as an inner savings account. You know, we often concentrate on putting money in the bank, but I think what's more important is to gather the resources within for dealing with any crisis, because reality is going to make a house call in every life more than once. The question I've often asked myself is, what can I bring to the ICU? While I was writing this book, I got a call that my mother had had a severe stroke. She was in the intensive care unit, and I'm her only child. So I was next to her for 35 days as she was teetering between life and death. And I realized as I was sitting there, like anybody, I was thinking, how can I find something to support my mother and to sustain myself? My bank account was a very limited use. My resume was beside the point. All the books I've written, no help at all. The only thing I could bring to that situation was whatever resources I'd gathered within. And I think I've gathered resources only by sitting still in silence, not by racing around the world, not by going to the bank and the pharmacy, not by filing my tax returns. I'm glad I have to do all those, but they're not really sustaining the deepest part of me. And I say all this, of course, because everybody, whether it's a car crash or a bad diagnosis or a sudden loss of somebody you love, all of us are facing these challenges and have to think about what we have to bring to them. And I have found my time in silence and on retreat to be my best medicine and best preparation for those moments, partly by witnessing the monks and their unwavering strength.
So I'm glad you brought up that question. What have I brought for my mother? Mm-hmm. Because we've talked almost exclusively about what we personally can get by finding these places of quiet and silence. And yet that is not the ultimate aim of this retreat, is for us to soak this in or come to healing or whatever. And you draw a parallel with two people who I hadn't thought about their work this way. And the first is the Dalai Lama, and the second was Thoreau. Let's talk about the Dalai Lama. How long have you known him?
I've known him for 50 years, and I talk and travel with him regularly. And for 10 straight years recently, he would come to Japan, and I and my wife would travel right next to him for every minute of his working day, 8 hours a day. So I've been lucky enough to spend a lot of time with him. His gift to all of us is, I think, as your question suggests, he's really almost never been on top of a mountain or sequestered in a monastery. He's always in the midst of us, extending a hand to wherever they're suffering or wherever people are in need. He's on the streets of New York City or Belfast or Jerusalem or Calcutta. And as you know, I describe him in the book as an emergency room physician of the mind.
I looked up his schedule, and it's only a couple of months into the year. He's had 6 public events already. And I thought that was incredible, especially for his age.
He turns 90 in July, and so his schedule's really slowed down. But for 40 years, I think, he was traveling between continents constantly. And when I would spend 8 hours a day with him, I was exhausted at the end of those 8 hours, just watching him go through his day-to-day routine, all the meetings and people he has to talk to. He showed no signs of tiredness, and he's 22 years older than I. And I realized it was because of that inner savings account. Every morning, while I was enjoying my beauty sleep and having a long buffet breakfast in the hotel restaurant, he was waking up and doing 4 hours of meditation every single day, even while he was traveling. And I think that's what gave him the strength and resilience to go through these very exhausting days. But as you say, even close to 90, he's maintaining quite a strong schedule. But to go to really the heart of your point, he's a living reminder, as is Thoreau, of how silence and solitude are only the means to greater compassion, a richer sense of community, and having much more to give to the people around you. And I remember when I go on retreat, I always feel really guilty to be leaving my aging mother behind for 3 days. And then when I go to the hermitage, I realize it's only by being there I can return and share calm and joy and excitement and all kinds of freshness with my mother. Because otherwise, sadly, when I'm there day to day, she's just getting my exhaustion and my distraction. So it's a kind of investment that by stepping away for a minute, I feel I can step back into the lives of my loved ones and my neighbors and have much more to give than I would otherwise. And I sometimes think amusedly that it's only by spending time on retreat in solitude I decided to get married. By being in solitude, I realized how important companionship and community and compassion are. And as during the enforced retreat of the pandemic, it's when I'm in solitude and silence, suddenly I remember most vividly my priorities, the people who are most important to me and what I should be doing in my life. So I think it's a surprising means to the essential end of being a better citizen and having more to give to the world.
You asked the Dalai Lama about his achievements. What was, what were his greatest achievements? And the answer was very surprising.
Yes, thank you. So this was 1996, and I went to visit him in his home in northern India in Dharamsala. And every afternoon, I would go and talk to him. And we have an extended series of conversations day after day. This was 7 years after he'd been awarded the Nobel Prize. 2 Hollywood movies were being made about his life at that time. He was really one of the most prominent people in the world. And so I asked him which of his great public achievements meant most to him. And he remembered a day when he'd been visiting Johannesburg and the township of Soweto, where the people who were given no opportunities in life at all were living. And he asked to meet just a typical black family in Soweto. And he was introduced to a house and he began to talk to them. And he said that he met a man there who had absolutely no hope. The man said to the Dalai Lama, "I've lived here 40 years. I've never had a chance to vote in my own country. I have no money. I have no prospects of a job. I just have no opportunities in the world." And the Dalai Lama talked to the man for an hour. And the Dalai Lama told me that he felt after that hour, the man had some sense of confidence. He realized he wasn't powerless and he saw that he could do something and his life wasn't hopeless. And the Dalai Lama said, that day I felt I'd made a contribution. So of all the things that he had achieved, and the Dalai Lama was 61 years old when we were having those conversations, what he remembered as his great achievement was helping one stranger in Soweto in South Africa come to a greater sense of confidence.
closer to home for us Americans, and so maybe somebody we can more easily identify with, is Henry David Thoreau, or at least the myth of Thoreau. See, we think we know what he was up to when we refer to some solitary place in our own lives as our own private Walden. We think of Thoreau when we rejoice in getting off the beaten path, but according to Pico Iyer, there was so much more motivating Thoreau besides achieving solitude.
I had certainly misunderstood Thoreau. I mean, I'd always thought of Thoreau as a sort of patron saint of loners going off to live in Walden Pond. But the more I researched it, the more I found he was in Walden Pond to write a book about his beloved brother who died in his arms. And in the middle of that book is a 23-page ode to friendship. He chose to build his cabin in Walden Pond right next to the railroad down which the train was thundering 20 times a day. And Thoreau was actually known as a center of the Concord community. He was the guy who fixed people's ovens, and he looked after Emerson's wife and children for 10 months while Emerson was on a lecture tour, and he would offer melon parties to the community. So he was only, again, stepping into that cabin in Walden Pond so that he could be a richer and more useful member of the community. And I was interested to notice that the very first lecture he gave at the Concord Lyceum was not on the subject of solitude, but society. And if you read Walden carefully, his great book, he says, I'm naturally no hermit. I love company as much as anybody else. And so it was useful for me to remember that even Thoreau was not after solitude, but solitude was the means to the more important end of helping others. Going on retreat to that very, very positive, liberating kind of silence reminds me of what are the important things in life: the beauty of the world around us, the compassion and selflessness of the monks I see, everything I can share without saying a word with the other retreatants who are there. And I remember what I love, and I also recall what I ought to do for the next 6 months. So every time I go there, I come back with a much clearer sense of direction. The beauty of silence is it's non-denominational, it's available to all, and whatever your religion, I think you can find something of what I'm describing by stepping into a holy place or just taking the time to recall what's deepest inside you.
Pico Iyer is the author of many books, including his latest, Aflame, Learning from Silence. This episode was produced by me with help from Marcus Smith and Elaine Scott. Sound design by James Call. If you like what you're hearing on Constant Wonder, please give us a 5-star rating or leave a positive comment wherever you're listening. Or share this episode with someone you love. I'm Tenery Taylor. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.
There's another podcast you might like from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's called In Good Faith. Stephen Kapp Perry is the host. He visits with people of various faith traditions. These guests are generous and compassionate and share in their own words firsthand experiences of their faith, hope, and belief. It's a chance to deepen our collective understanding of what it's like to live a spiritual life. And by the way, Stephen has a global perspective. He has cultivated that over a lifetime of travel, and that enlivens every conversation he has. In Good Faith, an inspiring journey. Be sure to listen wherever you get your podcasts.